I think just about every person in the world can agree that there's plenty of evil in the world to go around. We just can't seem to agree what is exactly evil. Part of evil keeps changing its name. The Islamic nation apparently is neither Islamic nor a nation. The evil that used to be global warming is now the evil called climate change, and people are having trouble convincing other people that that's an evil thing that we can do anything about. Whatever the Tea Party is, it used to be called the John Birch Society. And back about 100 years before that, it was the most accurately identified as the Know-Nothing Party. But then there are people who also believe that capitalism is wrong, or that unregulated capitalism is evil, or that overly regulated capitalism is evil, or that abortion is evil, or the education of women is evil, or the existence of Israel is evil, or that class warfare is evil, but especially when it's the rich against the poor against the rich. The class warfare of the rich against the poor is simply called the way things are. And so about every 20 years or so, Unitarian Universalists in some part of our denomination begin to think that we suffer because we don't have a clear theology of evil. And I say this as a warning, because if it is indeed every 20 years, we're due for another round in about 5 years. It's said that Unitarian Universalists are too optimistic about humanity, too sheltered in their comfort and privilege. We used to say too comfort in their middle class privilege, but enough of us have fallen out of the middle class that we suffer a little more, so our theology is getting more grainy. We're removed from the depth and breadth of suffering in the world, it is said, and that's a problem. But is having a clearer or more profound theology of evil the answer? I don't think so. There are two problems I have with the phrase theology of evil. The word theology and the word evil. I'm perfectly fine with of. My problem with theology goes back to the fact that I was a philosophy major in college, and I loved studying philosophy to the extent that I was able to comprehend it or stay awake while reading it, because it took the blinders off of life. It enabled the mind to run free from where it would. It would see that all systems of thought had preconceptions that are beyond reason. And when I got to divinity school and was taught to think theologically, to me it was like putting blinders on. It was from going to looking through the spectrum in all light to a very narrow spectrum of one color and just a few shades. To me, theology was entirely Christian apologetics. Theology requires a particular outlook of who God is and what he does. And it didn't make sense to me to put those blinders on for anybody. So I knew I was at the right place as a Unitarian Universalist. But really, almost no other religion really has this kind of theology, this study of God. Judaism and Islam are ethical systems, certainly, and obeying God's law is important, but they aren't really theological systems in the same sense. Hinduism is mythology. Buddhism is contemplative philosophy. Theology, on the other hand, uses the instruments of philosophy to dissect regional and tribal systems of belief, which is like trying to dissemble a Model T using forceps and scalpels. Ultimately, it is using rationality to understand what is beyond the rational. It will only get you so far. When the Zen master D.T. Suzuki first visited America, he was asked by some reporters, what is the theology of Zen Buddhism? And he said, from what I understand of theology, we don't have theology. We dance. Now, my problem with evil is that good and evil are really imported to Christianity from the Persian Zoroastrians. Judaism, for all its morality and legality, doesn't really deal with good and evil in that Zoroastrian sense. It deals with, did the Jews keep the law, or did the Jews not keep the law? Did the Jews keep their covenant with God, or did they not keep their covenant with God? And what does it mean? What do we need to do to keep the covenant with the God? And it's always, all throughout the Old Testament, our God versus their God, or gods. The Psalms are an amazing collection of beautiful works, partially because they range so broadly from nature poetry to love poetry to the exaltation in slaughtering the children of the other tribes. The Yom Kippur atonement never extends to the Ammonites. All this heaven and hell stuff within Christianity was really imported into the Old Testament. All this saved and damned stuff. All about this Christian good and evil. You know, there's very, very little of it in the Bible. Jesus preaches love and compassion. He doesn't preach so much about good versus evil. In fact, some of the words that are translated into English as such are quite mistranslations. The word that is often translated as hell, you're going to go to hell, is Sheol, which in the Old Testament simply means grave. It means, if, you know, you're going to be dead pretty soon, so why don't you make something of your life? The ever-burning fire that we often hear about in terms of being damned or saved or being born again is a translation of the word Gehenna. Gehenna means the valley of Hinnom. Hinnom was outside of Jerusalem. It was the trash heap of Jerusalem. It was where they kept an ever-burning fire. It was where they threw the bodies of the criminals who could not be buried in sanctified ways. So what Jesus was saying, if you don't change your ways, you're going to end up on the trash heap. You're going to end up burning with the criminals. It's not some metaphysical, ever-burning hell. Now, there is a philosopher that, for me, first articulated these origins of good and evil and how Christianity, in his opinion, used it to enslave its followers rather than to free them. It was Friedrich Nietzsche. His book called Thus Spoke Zarathustra, where he uses the voice of that Persian god to speak for a morality that is not Christian, but beyond good and evil, which indeed was the title of his most famous book. In that, he states that humanity is motivated not by good or evil, but by the will to power. And forever after that, he was pilloried and smeared as a deranged, mad, and even evil person. Now, the fact is, he was a deranged, mad, and possibly evil person. But that doesn't mean his philosophy was wrong. He had his finger on something. Because it is my perception from my experience that while people ought to be motivated to do good and resist evil, however they define it, in fact, people are usually more motivated by the will to power. Both the will of the powerful to get more and the will of the weak to get a little. And very often, those who most loudly suggest that they know who is doing evil are in fact those who are most intoxicated by the will to power. In fact, the use of theologies of good and evil to get more political power for themselves and deny it to others, to me, is the more common use of theology. For instance, the heresy trials throughout the centuries. You may know that the witch trials in Salem were really a thin veneer for a land grab, and that the women accused of being witches were often landowners that could be very easily disenfranchised. The term axis of evil that we heard in the Bush administration. It always was interesting to me that all the axes of evil either had a very copious supply of oil or of opium. And one thing that bothers me is the consistent comparison of leaders to Hitler. This leader is like Hitler, that is like Hitler. It is one of the legacies of the evilness of Hitler that people are compared to him. Because Pol Pot was not Hitler. And Obama's not Hitler. And Reagan's not Hitler. And nobody's Hitler. Let Hitler be Hitler. There's enough evil in leaders today to go around. We heard the term evildoers after 9/11. The evildoers. It's because you didn't know who they were. But it did always seem to me that it was sort of easy to tell who the enemy was in Iraq. As if we killed them, they must have been the enemy. The enemy is a phrase that Orwell used in all his work. And he understood the fluidity of who the enemy is. That great book that at least my generation had to read in high school, Lord of the Flies. You know, if there's not an evil there, we'll get one from somewhere. The American concept of evil dispersed with the fall of the Soviet Union. We've been auditioning enemies for so long. And the proliferation of enemies seems to follow the proliferation of television channels. You know, when I was a kid, there were 3 television channels and 1 enemy. And now there's a million television channels and a million enemies. When I was a kid, I spent most of my Saturday mornings watching cowboy movies on TV. It's very easy to tell the good guys from the bad guys, right? The good guys wore the white hats. The bad guys wore the black hats. And you know, I think I was a Unitarian for a long time because my favorite cowboy was the Cisco Kid, who wore black with like white brocade because he was Mexican. You know, he really upturned all, you know, I really liked him. And then there was Lash LaRue, who dressed completely in black and carried a whip. We will not be talking about him anymore today. There's also an idea to me that seems evil, and that is love the sinner and hate the sin. Love the sinner and hate the sin. If it's a murderer, if it's a thief, that's fine. But to call who I am and label it from my behavior and call it a sin is evil. It's the essence of homophobia and has been for a long time. You know, I got nothing against gay people if they only wouldn't behave as though they were gay. You know, that's my problem with everybody. You know, I could just love everybody if they just wouldn't behave the way they need to behave. Love the sinner and hate the sin. I don't really understand that. I feel it's used to spread fear and confuse people and to maintain power, not share it. Good and evil used clearly by religious leaders, often fundamentalist, pushing their religious agendas all over the world, every religion, every nation, calling each other evil, and sometimes I think they're both right. How often we've heard there will be no compromise with evil, there will be no reconciliation with evil. And every person who advocates every war never thinks he or she is doing evil. They think they are fighting evil. Because of the history of this church, I've gone back to the Civil War more and more and see how the unresolved issues there that we thought might have been resolved at Gettysburg or Appomattox were unresolved at Ford's Theater and remain unresolved today. And both sides thought they were fighting evil. So does evil not exist? Of course it exists. I believe it exists like God exists. As a metaphor, as a way of naming something real and elusive and ultimately beyond our understanding. It's not a precise entity or quality out there. It's like hot and cold. Hot is an activity as molecules get more vigorous. And cold is a relative term as those molecules slow down. And that's what it is with good and evil. Good is an active force. It gets active and it gets warm. And when it recedes, what is left is a negative capability, a lacking, a void. That is evil. In 1963, Hannah Arendt wrote her Eichmann in Jerusalem, where she coined the very useful phrase, the banality of evil, saying that Eichmann himself was an apparatchik. He spoke in cliches and repeated policies. He was simply a joiner who got his identities and values from this group identity. But there has been further research on Eichmann that said that Hannah Arendt was fooled by the real evil of Eichmann. That he wasn't just doing his job, he was doing his job and reveling in it. He fooled her. The banality of evil, of which she wrote, was not in the Nazis, whose evil was rococo and elaborate and deep. But the banality of evil is in the ordinary German who saw but chose not to see, who could have acted but did not act. And today, it is still evil to see but choose not to see, to be able to act and not act. What we choose to see and choose to do, our choices are derived still not from so much good and evil, though perhaps they should be, but from our relationship to power and to privilege and to fear. Theodore Parker, the transcendentalist minister that was the guide to the founders of this church, said about the 1850s, you know, you think of the time leading up to the Civil War was a hotbed of discussion about slavery with the Lincoln-Douglas debates. The Lincoln and Douglas debates were so important because it was so unusual that slavery was being talked about. In the 1850s and the 1840s, slavery was not talked about. Slavery was thought of as being an acceptable evil of the time. It was something that our economy was based upon. It could not be called into question, or the underpinnings of society from which we got our privilege would be lost. And that's why the abolitionists and the transcendentalists were so marginalized, because they were the first people who said, it's wrong. The banality of evil today, the Rush Limbaughs of the world, who say what they say to increase their greed, to have their greed satiated. The media distractions of the multi numbers of channels. Consumerism, materialism, and greed, which makes it easy for us not to see and not to act. At the first conference on racism that I went to at the Unitarian Universalist Association, a leader said, "Never think of racism as evil, because if you do, you will never think to look for it in yourself." So what must we do to increase our ability to lessen suffering in the world, to get out of our comfort zones, to stand on the side of love, and not sit on the sidelines of distraction and fear? Theodore Parker, that minister, said, "Democracy in the 1850s had sewn its mouth shut with iron thread." And Theodore Parker was a mouth that opened. And he opened others. What do we do to be more effective Unitarian Universalists and work for social and economic justice? Not to develop a theology of evil, but to be aware of the banality of evil and the negative capabilities of evil, and to encourage what I find to be the one sure cure of it, which has defined Unitarians and Universalists in all times. And that is simply the ability and the willingness to think for yourself. May we join together in our closing hymn, number 287.